This is Andrea Chase, and I'm talking with Neil Berger about his film, The Illusionist, directed and adapted by Berger from a short story by Stephen Milhauser. It tells the story of Eisenheim, an illusionist extraordinaire who dazzles his audience with wonders beyond belief and who finds himself at the nexus of history in fantasiacal Vienna as he rediscovers his long-lost and forbidden true love, Sophie, and thereby runs afoul of the heir apparent to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The film stars Edward Norton, Paul Giamatti, Rufus Sewell, and Jessica Biel. Berger's previous work also dealt with illusion in his interview with the assassin, and I would love to start by asking about that film. It was filmed in cinema verite style, and I've always wondered how many people were fooled. How many people thought it was true?
I would say about 25% of the audience was fooled, yeah. I remember showing it at a screening on the Upper West Side in New York, and, you know, audience of pretty smart college-educated people, and some, you know, the moderator asked how many people believed it, and all these sort of hands went tentatively up, and which was really gratifying, but also incredibly disturbing at the same time because it's a fake documentary, but it's told in a, you know, very true way. So
I'm going to get a little philosophical with you. What is it about that, and also about some of the things that come up in The Illusionist about wanting to believe in conspiracy and magic and the illusions that life throws at us?
I think it's less about wanting to believe in conspiracies than conspiracies being something that fills the void when there's an absence of truth and people try to figure out, you know, what actually happened and create scenarios for what possibly would have happened. And I think that the way the two movies are related is that they're both about how do you know what's true and blurring this line, as you say, between truth and fiction. And in particularly in Interview with the Assassin, it becomes this sense of, you know, how do you negotiate your life when truth is a subjective concept where you can't really nail down anything. You know, how do you live your life in that kind of world? And in The Illusionist, it's a little bit different, but it's certainly about blurring the line between truth and illusion and art and reality. The whole movie walks a very fine line between does Eisenheim have some sort of powers or is it all some kind of trick? And if you can't quite ever get the answer to the secret, how do you deal with that? For some of the characters in the movie, it drives them absolutely crazy.
What does it say about people that they just can't accept, like the people in the film, who just can't accept that maybe there is some magic going on here?
There's people in the movie who are more spiritualists and who like being astonished and want to believe. And then there are these people who are strict rationalists who need to know the answer to everything. And I think, you know, both of those ideas can coexist in the world and should coexist in the world. I don't think either side of it works very well. But I think it's when either side of those, and in this case, in this movie, it's the rationalists who become extremely prideful and arrogant and hubristic, and it leads to their downfall.
It was such an interesting time, you know, the late 19th century and the early 20th, because you had this spiritualist music movement. You had, like, Madame Blavatsky. People had come to the fore in the Ordo Templo Orientalis and Aleister Crowley, and you also had the rationalists working at the same time. I mean, I can't imagine the story taking place anyplace else or any other time with such effect.
Obviously, it was the dawn of modernity, if you will, in that kind of societal upheaval. You know, things were changing in those times of political turmoil. People seemed to inevitably crave some sort of spiritual guidance or foundation or some sort of spiritual leader. And in this case, they kind of hang on to Eisenheim. But it's an incredibly interesting time because it's leaving this mystical world behind and moving into the modern times.
Oh, and I forgot Freud, who is a whole different
right.
kind of spirituality going on in
yeah,
Vienna.
That's right. Freud and whole new, incredibly interesting art movements. And it was really the turning point in so many different places and cultures.
This was based on a short story, and I'm always curious about this, the pleasures and perils of adapting a short story for the big screen.
Well, yeah, it's based on Stephen Milhauser's short story, Eisenheim the Illusionist. It's a beautiful, transcendent gem of a story, but not quite a movie. But somehow I was stuck with it because it's actually, the imagery in it is very cinematic, and I wanted to make it into a film, but it lacked certain kind of narrative structure that a film would need, and so then I had to create, it's only about 20 pages long, and so I had to create that structure, that narrative context, in order to maintain the beautiful story. So to that end, I created the character of Sophie and the character of the Crown Prince and expanded the role of Inspector Uhl, who's played by Paul Giamatti in the movie.
If people have seen the film Meyerling, I think they'll have an inkling of what's going on with that whole thing. And you've added a conspiracy on top of a conspiracy for that, which
that's
I
right.
just endured.
Right. The character of the Crown Prince is based on Crown Prince Rudolph, who actually lived about 11 or 12 years before, and he committed suicide under mysterious circumstances in this suicide pact with his mistress. But people had thought at the time, and still do, that he was trying to actually overthrow his father and split the empire. And so we play with certain of those ideas. And again, it's fiction. All of it, whether it be the illusions or the political situation, you know, they're based on real characters or real situations.
I want to talk a little about Eisenheim's illusions, because you base them on illusions that people were doing actually at the time, and they're just extraordinary, even to someone who's used to watching CGI and a lot of illusionists working today. How much of this did you want to do with CGI, and how much of it were you very tempted to want to recreate exactly as it was done at those times?
Yeah, I didn't want to do any of it with CGI or digital effects, because, I mean, the audience today is so sophisticated with film techniques and with special effects and CGI, as you say. But, you know, I didn't want them thinking about how I did the tricks. I wanted them to be thinking about how Eisenheim did them. And so to that end, we really did them as they would have done them at the time. And as you say, all the illusions are based on real illusions at the time that I then adapted and pushed in various degrees and altered. And we really did them as they would have done them. In most cases, obviously, there's always concerns with scheduling and budget and things like that. And we didn't have a ton of money, but, you know, we had enough money, but we always had to keep moving. And so in certain cases, we had to kind of take some liberties. But in general, I would say, you know, 90% of it is either done in camera with mirrors or projections or mechanically. I'm very happy that we were able to do it that way.
And using just the technology that would have been available at the time?
Exactly. And Edward Norton learned all of his own sleight of hand. Everything you see him doing in the movie is something that he has learned to do and he's really doing.
Ricky Jay was the consultant for him?
That's right. Ricky Jay was an incredible magician and the greatest living sleight of hand artist right now, and also an incredible historian of magic. And that's really what I was most interested in, because, you know, after I wrote in fact, when I was writing it, he was the first, before any cast members or anybody like that, I was thinking of Ricky Jay being involved in the movie, because he is such a great historian. And so after I had written it, I met with him and filled in some holes with the illusions, and in a way just got his blessing as well.
I'm thinking particularly the illusion of the orange tree. Well, I guess everyone will come away from this film thinking about that one. Where do you even begin to start recreating that without giving it away? Because I think the lead mystery.
No, the orange tree is kind of a famous illusion that was invented by a magician named Robert Houdin, who was a French magician in the 1870s, kind of was the height of his fame. And he trained as a watchmaker. And so when he became a performer, he transferred that skill of and the mechanics involved to the stage. And he created all sorts of robotic and automaton effects. And the orange tree was a mechanical tree that came to life, grew on stage. And so, you know, I took that idea and twisted it a bit, but it's still a mechanical that Eisenheim is able to create.
And Houdin, that's where Houdini took his name from.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Ricky Jay, giving away a lot of these tricks, did you...
He gave away nothing. He has a company called Deceptive Practices, and their motto is, on a need-to-know basis, and he adheres to that strictly. So, you know, he gave away a little bit, but nothing more. You could never say to Ricky, like, well, show me how that trick is done. It was just like, is it going to be in the movie? And it's like, no. Well, then there was no giving it away.
Would you want to know?
Well, you know, I'm somebody that likes the idea of being astonished, and I obviously want to know as well. And all the tricks in the movie, if I didn't figure out a method to them, I was able to create a method for them. But I kind of like being lost in the maze and still knowing the plan of the maze.
You filmed on location in Prague. How was your Czech?
My Czech is an extremely difficult language. It's one of those languages where no means yes, and I just never quite mastered it, and I was there for 5 months.
Does that disorientation help when you're telling a story about misdirection?
I guess. You're sort of in a fog of production the whole time, working kind of 24/7 on it, and you make the film, and, you know, you get to see very little of the country except what you see through a location van window. But That said, I saw some amazing things, but never quite nailed the language.
You had so much more money to work with than you did an interview with The Assassin. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, I think the budgets for both films were as they should have been. The Interview with The Assassin was under $1 million, and this was $16 million. You know, in each case, we could have used a little bit more. But Interview with The Assassin, we shot almost as in a documentary style. And so everybody, I'm sure, could have been paid a little bit more, but it was right. And this was a pretty elaborate period piece with dozens of horses and carriages and huge scenes in theaters with 350 extras all in period costume, which just takes that kind of money to pull a production off like that.
Is it freeing, or do you worry more about every shot when you have that much money?
You know, it didn't feel like it was that much money. I mean, it just felt like $16 million is a lot of money. So there's no question about it. But it was the appropriate, I mean, the way a movie is shot and what things cost, it was the right amount of money. So it didn't feel intimidating in that sense. It just felt like we were making the movie and this is what we needed to do.
I want to talk a little about the casting. Edward Norton, of course, is amazing. He has this ability to be strong and tender. And Rufus Sewell, I think he's just my favorite bad guy.
He is. I knew I needed somebody to be as strong to oppose Edward Norton, because Edward Norton's an intense, intimidating guy, and he was playing the lead role, and you know, Rufus is his nemesis in a way. And I needed somebody who had the same kind of power and fierce intelligence. The Crown Prince is not a sniveling weakling. He's like an incredibly smart guy and quite, in fact, is right about a lot of what he says in the movie and trying to expose Eisenheim. And Rufus is he's a powerful presence who doesn't suffer fools. His rage is enormous in the movie.
But not in real life, I should hope.
No, he's a delightful guy. Rufus is amazing, actually. I mean, he's done so many movies. He's actually done so many movies in Prague and is actually he's in London right now in Tom Stoppard's new play, which is called Rock and Roll, which is about Tom Stoppard in Prague. So he just can't get away from it.
I want to talk a little about one of the locations. It was this castle full of antlers, and it's almost overkill.
Well, overkill is right, because it's the Crown Prince's hunting lodge, which is actually more of like a rustic castle. The location is outside of Prague, and it is a real castle, and it was owned by Archduke Ferdinand. And Archduke Ferdinand was, of course, the one that was shot out in Sarajevo, and that killing of that assassination began World War I. And it was his beloved home, and what his favorite thing to do was hunt, and he must have killed 50,000 animals in his life, and they are all there, all mounted on the wall. And so, yes, there's that scene walking down that hallway, which is like, and you didn't even see the half of it. It's a 200-foot hallway that is lined floor to ceiling with antlers and heads of animals, and it's just intense, and I think it was intensely bad karma for him because he ended up dead as well.
How hard is it to get permission to film in a place like that? Because it must be, despite the antlers and the macabre, of that, it's a national treasure.
Yeah, it is a national treasure, and obviously we had to be extremely careful when we were shooting in there, but we were able to film there. One of the nice things about the Czech Republic is they are willing to do those things. But, I mean, obviously it didn't come for free, and we were lucky to squeeze in just before they were opening for the season.
There's this wonderful heart that Eisenheim gives Sophie when they're kids that mm-hmm. just opens and opens and opens.
Right.
And it's an actual heart in the film.
It's a locket, yeah. It's a locket that the boyhood character of Eisenheim has made, and he's the son of a cabinet maker and learns these cabinet making skills himself, which help him later with his magic boxes and things like that. But yeah, he carves this locket, and it has a secret mechanism that twists it into the shape of a heart and then opens it.
Where did you get that? Did you specially commission it, or?
Oh, we designed it for the movie, and Michael Weber, who works with Ricky Jay, is Ricky Jay's partner, came up with the initial, I mean, there's a locket obviously in the screenplay that has a secret mechanism, and Michael was able to figure out exactly how the mechanism could work, because obviously I was writing it, and it was a kind of a great idea, but it was, you know, it was to figure it out practically was the next thing, and Michael did that and put his own stamp on it, and then we took it the next step with Andre designing the kind of wood and the way it's inlaid with a butterfly.
Who gets to keep it after the film is done?
We have it.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful story about Paul Giamatti. When you first wanted to hire him, he was not that well known.
Well, when I first met Paul, actually, I first met Paul on the day that Sideways opened, and it was great because he was actually having this triumph with Sideways. You know, it had gotten incredible reviews, and I was meeting with him, and the only thing he wanted to do next was my movie. He'd read the script and loved it and wanted to be a part of it. So that was incredibly flattering and gratifying.
And suddenly very bankable, which can't.
Right. No, that always helps, yeah.
And just one last question, getting back to Interview with the Assassin. Did you become an object of fascination for the conspiracy buffs?
I was slightly worried about that I was going to be stalked or something like that. But no, it was interesting because I would show it, and it was generally well received, but there would always be one or two people in the audience, and it would make them very angry because it wasn't their conspiracy theory. And actually, the movie isn't a conspiracy theory movie because it's about a guy who claims to have been a part of it, and it's not clear whether he's telling the truth or whether he's deluded or crazy or whether he has some other agenda. And so it uses those elements of conspiracy theories and the theories that exist, but hopefully to ends that are larger than that one crime.
Yeah, well, I think it says something about the zeitgeist in general.
Yeah.
Like The Illusionist, there's endless questions and endless speculation, and we can all be right.
That's right. Or wrong.
Neil Berger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.